I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hoonie Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
We also have to be honest that like the moment that millions are now facing is a place that many people in our country were already at. And that this is just shining a light on the issues with the lack of structural systems that we have as a society, as a country, and also definitely within our industry.
The date is April 9th, 2020, and that is Ashton Berry, sommelier, beverage consultant, and educator, our guest on this special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is a special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. As always, my great thanks to Sam Pellegrino for covering the production cost of these special reports. We wouldn't have been able to deliver them to you without them. Before I introduce today's guest to you, as mentioned yesterday, I have a bit of homework for you to do. Please, before you listen to this Friday show, that's tomorrow's show, if you haven't already seen it, or if you haven't seen it recently, watch the Bradley Cooper starring movie Burnt, the saga of a Michelin-starred chef on the road to personal and professional recovery. I don't want to say too much about it, but we're going to have some fun at its expense. It will be the topic of our entire episode this Friday, and I'll have a special guest here to help me do that. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I want you to get the most out of it. So please watch that movie if you can. It is available on Amazon, Vudu, Google Play, and other platforms. And then meet us back here on Friday or whenever you get around to it this weekend to listen to us take a crowbar to poor Bradley Cooper. Okay, today's guest is Ashton Berry. If you're not familiar with Ashton, and I have to say she and I had never met before. We met over the phone recently, thanks to my friend Jen Dirksen from Share Our Strength, who made the introduction. But Ashton is a New Orleans-based bartender and beverage consultant who describes herself also as an educator. She studied sociology at the University of Chicago in her hometown and is devoted to creating safer and more inclusive spaces in the hospitality industry. In addition to her work, which has earned her honors, such as being named Imbibe's 2019 Bartender of the Year, Ashton tackles such thorny issues as bias in hiring practices, inequality in staffing, and a lot of other topics that many find uncomfortable to get into, but which I was glad to engage with her on. I think this is a perfect follow-on to last night's conversation with Catherine Miller from the James Beard Foundation, because both Catherine and Ashton see in this moment that we're in, and hopefully in the not-too-distant moment when we come out of this crisis, a chance to do some work and bring the hospitality industry to a better place as we rebuild it. I mentioned this in the interview as well. Ashton raises more questions than we can adequately tackle in a half hour, which is all the time we have for these nightly special reports. So I'm looking at this conversation as a down payment on what I hope will be a larger conversation when things are back to relative normal in the world. And I hopefully Ashton and I find ourselves either in one or the other's cities or at the same conference or festival. I always have my gear with me, and I hope we'll get to record a significantly longer conversation. But please do give her your ear and your open mind. She is a challenger of the status quo, an asker of difficult questions, and a believer in a better way. And I'm glad we had this conversation. Do we call what you do activism? How do you define your work outside of your, I was going to say day job, but I guess probably night job?
I mean, I guess I'm just an educator. And then I would say, like, I also do, I do advocation. I do activate people. But I would say my primary tool is more about getting people to understand why they should be activated, and giving them the tools to make critical decisions on their own rather than it is organizing. Organizing is just kind of like the next level of once people are educated, then their question is, well, what do I do? So it just kind of became kind of the next layer of my work. But, you know, at the core, I would say I'm more of an educator.
So what for you right now? I mean, I've looked at some of the stuff that you've put out, certainly on social media and whatnot. I've looked at the three-point plan that you've been in support of. But what, you know, this is obviously a very fraught moment, well, for everybody, really. Am I correct in assuming you'd agree with me? It's especially fraught for this, for the restaurant and bar industry because of the nature of it.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, there is going to be change, right? We all know that. It's unavoidable. We don't know what exactly it'll look like. And it seems to me, if I understand what I've read about your work, that there seems to me to be both extraordinary opportunity in this moment, or as we start to turn the corner out of this moment, and also some extraordinary challenges, obviously, with where we are right now. Is that a fair way to sort of assess the kind of vector of where you exist right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two different things. I think, yes, I think in terms of the number of people this is affecting, I think, yes, absolutely. We are in a fraught moment that is really challenging. But I think we also have to be honest that like the moment that millions are now facing is a place that many people in our country were already at. And that this is just shining a light on the issues with the lack of structural systems that we have as a society, as a country, and also definitely within our industry. I think there's a ton of opportunity. I think there is always opportunity when we face some of the most challenging moments, because it's an opportunity for transformation.
So what for you would be the wish list of what we should be looking at? And maybe let's get to potential solutions in a minute. But the wish list of what we should be examining within the hospitality industry as we all sort of come to terms with this time we're in and think about how we want to come out of this crisis.
Yeah, I think if I could name what we should be looking at, I would say it's three main things and they're interconnected. I think the first would be top-down power structures that look at the evolution and creation and transformation of our systems, always from people who have access to financial power, social capital, which is also a form of power, or who are within traditional forms of leadership. I think that's something we definitely need to look at, because what we know to be true is that people who are facing targeted oppression or suffering due to systemic or structural issues are going to be the people who have the best knowledge about where our systems are broken. And so they need to be put in the place where their voices are heard over those who have the access. That's not to say that people in leadership shouldn't be having conversations. It's about decentering the conversations on them, because they won't be the ones who are most impacted. I think the second thing is understanding the intersection that where we are right now, understanding the social economic intersection, but also the racial and gender intersection. What we know right now is that about 7 to 1 Black people are dying from COVID comparative to those who are white. And we don't even have numbered on undocumented workers, right? I imagine that number is even higher for them. So what we need to really understand is the intersection of socioeconomic status, gender, and race as it applies to who is going to be most graciously impacted. And that goes back to my first point about why it's important for us to decenter who is in power as the people who are creating the systems that will help us get out of this and transform into a better industry. And then I think the third one is understanding that just because we have not seen it does not make it possible. The human brain is capable of imagining great things, and so we must not limit our ability to create based on the fact that we have never seen it done before. And it also means that we might have to look outside of our industry, might have to look outside of our country. We may have to look at things that we are not used to looking at in different value systems in order to find inspiration for what transformation could look like.
So you said something in the third point there that really caught my attention. Just because we haven't seen it doesn't mean we can't, well, how did you put it? We can't imagine it, or it can't happen?
We can't create it.
When you say that, do you say that with something specific in mind, or do you say that just with the notion that if enough smart, motivated people put their heads together, there has to be a way to achieve the sort of end that you're describing.
I'm saying that with multiple thoughts in mind, but to keep it short, I'm thinking of the conversations I've heard repetitively, which is that restaurants run this way because they have to run this way.
You're talking about the economic model.
Yeah, the economic model. But I'm also talking about even just the social model of how we even, how we put out job roles, how we think of job roles within our industry of who does what, and why, and what, and how those systems, have restricted our imagination about how our workplaces can operate. I think that I'm thinking about that, but I'm also just thinking in general of the terms of how so much of the conversations that I'm hearing right now lack a lot of imagination. And they are restrictive to just trying to make sure for survival. They're restricted to survival. And I find it interesting because a lot of the people leading these conversations are the people who have the access to the most resources. So I find it interesting that so much of their conversation is built on scarcity, rather than, you know, reimagining, because the fact of the matter is that that's what's going to be necessary to, in order to keep our industry going. I think that a lot of people, and Therese Nelson has stated this, and so many others have stated this who have been, in this industry and making historical accounts of how the growth of our industry for so long has stated this, that so many of the people in power seem like they're more interested in just getting back to business usual because that model worked for them. And so I am saying that because I think we have to remind ourselves that the system that we have worked in, if it wasn't working before, it certainly isn't going to work with less resources in the future. And so we can't limit our ability to create just because we haven't seen what a new model could look like.
So can we get really specific? What would be an example that would fit kind of under the umbrella of what you just described? So are we talking about the minimum wage for a restaurant worker? Would that be a fundamental example of what you're talking about?
I think a minimum wage for a restaurant worker would make sense. I think healthcare options that aren't, which is a issue that's outside of just our industry. But I think it's a conversation about why the 15 million workers within our industry should be pushing you for it. Our healthcare should not be tied to our productivity. It should not be tied to jobs, right? We should have access to healthcare outside of our productivity. And I think, and that's a preventative care measure. I think having a minimum wage, I think having healthcare, I think, you know, I was having a conversation with someone the other day about the wine industry when they were like, well, people just don't really care about these nuances about the wine industry. And I was like, I don't think that's true. I think people don't have the space to care because they're worried about so many other things, like their basic everyday life. And so I think also just access to upward mobility. How do we think about that? How do we reimagine that? Why is it that we have people who have been barbacking for 15 years, right? Why is it that predominantly only certain people are servers? Why is it that some people are able to start off as food runners and other people are immediately only given the access or opportunity to start as porters? We need to start reimagining what our biases is in hiring practices and where our biases lie on who can do what jobs and who can have upward mobility within our structures.
You know, when you and I talked last week, I kind of saw this conversation, and I still do, as sort of a down payment I'd like to make on a larger conversation when I'm doing, you know, fuller hour plus long shows. You know, hopefully we'll find ourselves at the same conference or something and we can break away and really get into like a lot of the nuts and bolts of this. But here's a big question I have about some of the monetary challenges that exist. And I'm not saying this to challenge what you're saying, but I think it's a question that just looms really large to me, as it does with a lot of issues around restaurants, which is, you know, I look at the example a couple of years ago when a number of people were trying to start incorporating, you know, to start having no tipping in their restaurants, you know, incorporating that money for their staff into the price of a meal. And a lot of eyebrows started to go up when people saw what the food cost, right? Now, it didn't actually cost any more. It's just, you know, you saw a bigger number on the menu, but you didn't have to add a tip at the end, right? But that was a, you know, I've had people explain to me that that was almost a table-by-table sales job for these restaurants that tried to do that, right?
Right.
And I think about a conversation I had with Mary Sue Milliken in Los Angeles a few years ago, actually on this show. And, you know, we were talking about all the things that restaurants really should do for their people, you know, and she said, you know, if we did all these things, you know, I think the bottom line is, and she believes in all these things, is, you know, the food's going to cost more, right? I think part of the reason, and I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but that some of these things hasn't happened is people are afraid to raise the prices in a way that it would take to pay for some of them. So my question is, at this crossroads we're going to be at, I hope it's soon that we turn the corner out of this crisis, but whenever it is, months from now, a year from now, and people are starting to take stock on how to rebuild, you know, we're going to be dealing with a population that's going to be in the midst of a recession, maybe a depression. Those are going to be the people who are going to be sought out as restaurant customers. How do we get the people on board with food that may cost more than it did before we all went through this trauma? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it makes total sense. And I think this is another issue that we have with, and that I've been talking to people on the Unite America Tables team, is that another one of the issues that we have is the lack of ignorance the general consumer has about the our agricultural food systems and the relationship that it has to our food and restaurants, and also the coexisting marginalization of both of these sectors, laborers. Like, there needs to be a transparent conversation about what is happening to laborers who work in food, agriculture, and in those food systems, and what is happening to them when we get to, as a consumer, buy things at a low price or even sell it at a lower price in a restaurant to give you this experience. First, I think we need to have a conversation about, is dining out a luxury, or is it a privilege, or is it something that people should have the right to do on the backs of marginalization of others? Like, we really have to ask ourselves that, because I think a lot of people think it's their right to own a restaurant. It's their right to own a bar, right? But I think that's your right, as long as the people who work within that system are also able to have access to basic needs. And I don't think it's a right for you to be able to own something that actively does not give support to people on a basic means. If people can't eat, pay their rent, have basic health care, then we need to start asking ourselves, is this industry a luxury? And if it is, in fact, a luxury, then that means that maybe everybody doesn't get to have one. And I think, and so, I, you know, that's not an answer that I think a lot of people are going to like. And I'm perfectly okay with that, because I'm more interested in the idea that people have access to living a healthy life, rather than us being able to say that we have the best restaurants and bars in the world or in whatever city. I think agricultural systems, we need to have a much more conversation about produce and meat and everything as a product. Like, we need to start talking about that. We need to start transparently talking about that system, and really allowing people to understand where that system comes from. And also, I think I explained it well. I don't think that the consumer actually understands how food is costed out. I don't think that they understand rent. I mean, we also need to have a conversation about the exorbitant prices that real estate is soaring, and kind of, yes, some of these things are market fluctuations, but some of these things are people gouging neighborhoods or certain areas so that only certain types of business can be in those areas. Right. And so we need to also talk about that. I mean, capitalism is a bitch.
I'm trying to think of questions I can ask that can be answered in the time we have. You know, you when I hear you describe it the way you just did, is it a, am I following it correctly that you think that? So let's call it a. I don't really like. I think a lot of the old language doesn't really work anymore. But let's say a fine dining restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like in principle you don't have a problem with that if what's already a relatively expensive restaurant is willing to be more expensive in order to support the food systems that that supply it, right? Farms and whatnot, in a way that supports those workers sufficiently and to pay their staff in a way that supports them better than they have been. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. So you don't have a problem with the idea of luxury, but the discrepancy between the luxury and the owner class and the employee is too wide.
Well, you have an owner who can own 5 restaurants or 9 restaurants or whatever, or you have people who are laying people off and not giving them their last check, but you look up, but they're worth millions, right? We've got a problem. Like that's too big of a discrepancy. The NRA just put out that the average hospitality full-time worker makes a business $87,000 a year. $87,000 a year. That was in their 2019 report. So explain to me that if your average full-time worker, now, of course, they are talking about businesses that are smaller. This was like, I believe in the report, they were focusing on independent restaurants, which they said most restaurants are independent restaurants with 50 employees or less. But that one worker makes them an average, and I think on the low end, it was something like 72 or something like that, to $87,000 a year. But you're telling me there's no way that you can offer them health insurance. Yeah, I think we got to have a conversation.
Now, take it to the other end of the spectrum for me. How does this break down and apply, let's say, to a diner, to a place where people by and large are going because it is, you know, you're not going for the ambiance, you're not going for the wine list, you're not going to tick it off your bucket list, you're going for convenience and because it's, you know, it's fast and it's cheap, right? So, but these same issues apply there, don't they? Isn't this sort of an industry-wide?
Yeah, I don't think that it changes. Like, I think industry-wide, this is an issue. I will say, though, out of all of the places that I've worked in my career, and I've had the pleasure of working at, like, sports bars, steakhouses, champagne bars, hotels, I will say that the places that I was most taken care of were the like sports bars I worked in. Maybe not by the consumer. The consumers were absolutely horrible, right? But in terms of like the access I had to like benefits, those were the best. Our margins were low. You're serving chicken wings and burgers, right? You're doing a bunch of turns. You're making a ton of money. You're selling a bunch of beer. You're selling a lot of alcohol. If you worked 35 hours or more at the place that I worked, you got access to healthcare and it wasn't super expensive either. Also though, we were run by a company by a couple that like really cared about those things too. So they made sure that everybody had access to that. And the people who worked there for years, even if all they did was come back and work there on the summer sometimes. Because they were taken care of. I think that people have to get creative. Like, and I think I talked to you about this, about how I have recommended to clients, like, how about you all in a neighborhood get together, like not a neighborhood, but if there's multiple businesses that operate in a neighborhood, why couldn't you guys get together, put money in a pot so that you all could get you guys' employees healthcare?
Right. Like, I don't know what the term is, but bundle the companies or, yeah, create a group. Yeah.
Create a group and bundle it, right? Yeah. You don't have to operate together in any other fashion, right? But you could create a group just to give access. And like, I have some former clients and current clients who have done that, who are like, yeah, it works great. Right. And then I have some former clients who are like, no, they didn't want to do this. But when the question was why, they could never answer it.
right? You just told me you couldn't provide this because of your margins and you didn't have enough money. I just provided a solution for how you could do that. And now you're saying no to that as well. Like, I'm not saying that the answers that we want to these problems are going to be just pop up out of the sky and be easy. I'm not saying that they won't provide inconveniences in terms of the amount of communication you may have to do or the amount of like maneuvering and lifting you may have to do on the top side. But like, wouldn't you rather do that in order to provide the people who work with you with some stability on the backside and also some insurance that you actually, more than you saying you care, you actually have put your money where your mouth is and actually showing them that you care?
How do you go about doing what you do? I assume you go to a fair number of conferences and things like that. Do you try to get meetings with the heads of restaurant groups? And how much wind is blowing back in your direction as you go about trying to get people to listen to and consider these ideas?
I'll be perfectly honest in saying that at the beginning, 3 years ago, when I started really consulting, I was mostly consulting on issues relating to gender and sexual violence within restaurants. And I happened to, through one of my clients, end up doing some operational work that ended up being very, very successful for them. And through word of mouth, got suggested and asked to work with some other people. And really, my career has kind of just moved from there. But like, one, I'll be perfectly honest in saying that, like, if I talk to someone and this isn't for them, it's not for them. And I'm not going to argue with you, and nor am I going to try to convince you. I'm not a conversionist. Like, this ain't no missionary work. I'm not coming here to like convert you to my form of thinking or working. Like, if you're not interested, you're not interested.
Was that a position or a point of view that it took you time to come to, or have you always thought of it that way? It seems very evolved and very healthy to me.
I mean, I used to,
but it took me until about age 50 to be that way.
I mean, I've spent my whole industry, like I've spent my entire career getting pushback. Like, I mean, I have always been outspoken. I'm young, I'm Black, I'm from the South Side of Chicago. Like, I wanted to be in wine, and there's been pushback at every single level of my career of being in this industry. And I have always had to figure out ways to advocate for myself and others in a way that would make sure that I also wasn't pushed out or blacked out from upward mobility, which at multiple occasions people tried to do to me. But what I learned is that like spending your energy being angry or fighting against people who have no interest in seeing you succeed is a waste of your energy. And energy is not something that is endless. You do not have an endless amount of energy to provide to the universe, right? So if your energy is best sent leaning into people who want to support you.
Well, you know, it's like I said before, I really do hope, and please consider this an open invite. I hope, you know, if you're in New York at some point, if I'm in New Orleans, if we're at the, you know, if we're in the same city for whatever occasion, I would love to have a much longer conversation, because I do feel, you and I had a pre-interview, which I rarely do. But you know, it was interesting to me, because I feel like I have a lot of, I've had a lot of access to a lot of the entrenched, I guess, thinking, point of view, attitudes that I think run against the grain of a lot of what you're saying. And I also feel like a lot of that, it goes so unexamined because it is so dug in. You know, like you and I had this conversation. I feel like, you know, a lot of people in this industry who did, you know, who worked for nothing for years, you know, who went over to France and worked for free and got treated, you know, people still wear that kind of experience as a badge of honor.
They should. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think like we have to, I think one of the biggest things and one of the biggest issues we have as we change generations prior to this and moving forward from this, one of the biggest issues is that we have is that value systems change. What was moniker for you can still be a moniker for you and can no longer be a moniker for the people who come after you. right? And what we have to stop doing is also we have to really decolonize and ask ourselves, why do we think that trauma or pain must come with succession? What about success has to be rooted in trauma and pain and the sacrifice? Like, yes, I do believe that you have to make sacrifices, but why must it be traumatic or painful or economically devastating for you to arrive at it?
Yeah. And I hope I'm clear. I totally agree with what you're saying. I just think it is very hard to move people off of that point of view. And I just think that's a heavy lift.
I think that's also the difference though, is like, I'm not trying to lift that, nor am I trying to get those people to say that their experience that they value isn't valuable. I did things at the beginning of my career that I value a lot, and that people who are now who are younger than me coming up will be like, why would I do that? That's not okay. You know? And I would say, you're absolutely right. But at the time, those were my options. And I felt like that was a good choice for me. And I think that a part of this is also uncentering ourselves in the conversation, and uncentering ourselves as individuals is a part of the conversation. And which I think is like part of what makes this so hard is that, you know, hospitality doesn't work without a collective. There's no way to have hospitality without team effort. However, so much of the way we have this conversation is rooted in individuals' eyes. And so uncentering ourselves so that we can have a conversation about the macro dynamics of our industry is really important. Understanding that your experience was valuable to you, but could be oppressive and targeting for another is part of like what we have to like kind of resolve. Anyways, to another conversation.
Thank you for all this. I think it's important, and I'm glad we got to speak, and I appreciate your patience coming on a second time to deal with the tech problems we had the first time.
Thank you so much, Andrew, and let me know if I could ever do anything in the future. I appreciate you having me on and having this conversation.
It's my pleasure. And that's our show for today. Again, our thanks to Ashton Berry for joining us. Ashton, again, open invitation for a longer conversation when the industry and the rest of us are all back on our feet. I look forward to continuing our dialogue at that time. Thank you to After School Special for today's music. Please seek them out online and enjoy more of their music. Thanks to our engineer, Margaret Kelly, for mixing these special reports. Our thanks to Sam Pellegrino for making these special reports possible. Again, a reminder, tomorrow, Friday, April 10th, we're going to be doing a conversation about the Bradley Cooper movie Burnt. If you haven't seen it recently or haven't seen it at all, please do watch it before listening for maximum enjoyability. Thank you all for listening. Take care of yourselves. Take a breath, and we will all get through this together. See you tomorrow.